Access number 27272, Mr. Malcolm Frost, Real 8. We're talking about your time, well, in and out of the line, just going through various things. But when you were promoted to corporal, you'd be able to use the corporal's mess when you were in reserve. Well, camp.
Yeah, it was basically a separate beer tent, if you like, where you could go and have a beer with the other NCOs. The same way the sergeant's mess was basically very much an area where the sergeants gathered. But we found in reserve it was quite common to have visitors from other units that were also in reserve, because we were in the brigade with the 1st and 3rd Royal Australian Rifles, so we tend to get quite a few Australian visitors when we were providing beer. But it was literally just a separate, if you like, beer tent where you could go on as an NCO and sit and have a beer with the other corporals.
Was that, and you got on well with the other corporals, obviously?
Yeah, oh yeah, for all of them, really. There were quite a lot, obviously, in the battalion. Can't remember how many there would be, but there was a hell of a lot of us.
Now, what's the next thing you remember happening? You know, you're...
I'm just trying to think as time goes by. Camp Casey, apart from the camp concert I told you about, the other thing I remember, as a corporal, you were given various duties. And I remember one evening, I was given the duty of guard commander. We had something like 3 or 4 prisoners under escort who had gone AWOL. And it was quite an amusing evening, because you had to turn the guard out every so often. And I remember hearing this tremendous commotion, and somebody came running down the track by the guard room, and it was an Australian being pursued by an Australian sergeant waving a starting handler from a jeep, and they disappeared actually out of the gate. And I discovered afterwards that the sergeant was quite drunk, and the other person was his driver, and apparently he couldn't get the jeep to start, and he was being pursued by the sergeant, an IRA sergeant, because he couldn't get his jeep going, both, which was quite funny. And life in Camp Casey was pleasant in some ways. I mean, this is where we were able to go, say, swimming when we're in reserve. We got our hour and a half from reserve, and it was just a complete break from the activities in the front line.
Now, anything happen when you're back in the line? You go back in again after 4 weeks.
Well, we had. I said 6 weeks. Six weeks in, 6 weeks out. But obviously, if I think back to the November incident of my wounding and going back to the line where the battalion had been, we obviously were in that area for more than 6 weeks. It would be near us 8-10 weeks. But my real main memory. Two main memories, I think, after Camp Casey, was we were back in the line, and I honestly don't remember the position, but we were warned that a prisoner had been taken, and he had confirmed that there was going to be a massive onslaught in our particular sector of the line, and we could expect a severe bombardment. I must admit, I was sceptical when I was passed his information, but that was true what he told us, because 2 nights later we came under the most intense artillery barrage. I've never experienced anything like it. Even where we were back in headquarter company, sort of a little bit back from forward line. Bearing in mind that, perhaps I should explain, I left the 3-inch mortar platoon when I was promoted. And I went back to headquarter company headquarters as such, as headquarter company corporal. And so we were in the command post with the CO, Lieutenant Colonel Stevens, and my job obviously was to keep communication with the whole battalion from that central point. So we were closer to the front line than the mortar platoon were, because they were back a bit, throwing their mortars over the top on the Chinese. We were a bit closer, and we came under this tremendous bombardment. And
what was it like?
It was difficult to describe because I was in my bunker when it started, and I was immediately alerted to go to the command post to make sure that communication was, because we thought maybe the Chinese were then going to launch an infantry attack. To actually get out of my, because I was off duty at the time, to get out of my bunk and to go, I have never trembled so much in my life. To go just from my bunker to the command post bunker, which was only comparatively short distance, 50, 60 yards, it was frightening. It was absolutely horrendous. I mean, there were shells falling all around. I felt quite sad because there was a New Zealand line crew who were trying to repair a line which had been blown out previously by the barrage, and I saw them as I was going across, and subsequently they were both killed, which I found quite sad. But yeah, I was petrified, I don't mind admitting. It was the first time, in all honesty, I'd come under what I would call a severe sort of threat to my being. I mean, yeah, we'd been mortared and we always managed to get undercover, but here we were in a situation where the artillery was so heavy that it was likely that even the bunkers were going to take a hit and could have been sort of destroyed. So that it was quite frightening. It went on for a long time. It was a heavy barrage, and there was no subsequent infantry follow-up to it. And when eventually it all subsided, it became quite normal and quiet again. But it was frightening at the time, I must admit. I would equate that to something like the London Blitz, you know, that sort of thing. So I remember that very much. And then, of course, moving on, the experience of the Hook was probably the most notable experience I could
remember.
Now,
what happened to the... Now, when were you posted down to the Hook? When did you move into
the
Hook?
Well, we were in reserve. It was April, back end of April, beginning of May. We were in reserve, and we'd been in reserve three or four weeks, I think. And I was headquarters signal corporal, and I was sort of running what we called the SDS, which was a special delivery service, because we had a jeep which would run around the battalion with any sort of special things which were not going out over air and so on. And I was running the SDS system as well. And
SDS?
Special delivery service. Yeah. And we got the message that we were going to be moving. We had to pack everything and get ready to go. And we moved as a battalion early evening.
This would be right about early May?
Beginning of May. We moved as a battalion to a position which I subsequently discovered, I mean, I didn't know at the time, was immediately behind the Hook, which was then occupied by the Duke of Wellington's regiment. We moved up first night, settled, nothing happened, and we moved back to reserve position the following morning. We did this, I think, for four nights. And on the fifth night, all hell was let loose. They'd apparently heard or captured a prisoner, or a prisoner, I think, had voluntarily walked into United Nations quarters and had said there was going to be an immediate assault. And so that was why we were being moved up. And I believe the Black Watch were also moved in a similar position. And then that night, the incoming artillery was absolutely horrendous. The trouble is, we were exposed. We weren't in a position where we were dug in. We had no real cover. And I must admit, I spent a lot of my time lying under a large lorry, sort of trying to get some protection. But the incoming artillery was apparently the heaviest of any time during the Korean War. Most of it was aimed on the forward positions of where the Dukes were, but I mean, we got quite a bit coming in, which were coming over top of the immediate front line. But I mean, the Duke of Wellington Regiment took a hell of a hit. And that morning, we were sent back to reserve to find this or pack everything up. And
so the Chinese had just fired; they hadn't attacked.
They attacked at the same time. They were throwing in this artillery cover, and so that night they had attacked the Dukes. Dukes actually repelled them, but with very heavy losses. And we went back to reserve position, got everything sorted, and we went back forward to the Hook to actually take over from the Dukes, and they were pulled off, and we took up a forward position on the Hook. Which meant we had to set up quite immediate communication, because it was it wasn't what we'd call the normal sort of handover. It literally was sort of a rush job, and we went in and took over from the Dukes, and they came out.
Now, what was the state of the ground and the trenches?
The Chinese had burnt a lot of the forward trenches out. They destroyed a lot of the forward fortifications, and there was a large number of dead, mainly Chinese, that were lying out in the sort of exposed area of what one would term as no man's land. So although I was in headquarter company and wasn't actually involved, a lot of our forward boys were bringing back bodies for quite several days that had been laid out in the open, mainly Chinese. And I always thought Chinese were small, but some of the Chinese or Mongolians that they brought back, I didn't imagine they were as tall as that. They were quite tall, but they brought back a lot of bodies, and then began to reinstate the defences. But that was pretty horrendous.
Did the Chinese attack again?
No, they were repelled by the Dukes, and once the fusiliers had taken up, well, there was the normal sort of forays of the shelling and mortaring, but they didn't let a full. I mean, the attack on the Dukes was a full scale onslaught, whistles blowing and bugles blowing and hand to hand fighting in the trenches. I mean, it was one of the major battles of the whole of the Korean War. We saw, if you like, the back end of it, because we were behind the line, behind the immediate front line, and when we went in, the initial attack had finished, and it was clear a mobbing up and tidying up and reinforcing operation, putting the things back together again, setting up communications again, relaying lines and all that sort of thing. So I remember that quite well.
What happened next then?
That was May. Well, excuse me a minute if I just get my bit.
Okay.
I don't know if I'd mentioned before the number of UK stars that came out to entertain. In reserve. I don't remember anything, but certainly Ted Ray, the comedian, came out with a concert party, which we were able to go and see. Frankie Hodd came out with Eve Boswell, the singer. There were some other American entertainers came out. There's one show I remember in particular it was an American show called Step Right Up, which we was touring around the battalion area when we were in reserve, and that was quite a professional, slick entertainment.
They were
brilliant shows. They were pretty sort of broad-minded type shows, you could imagine, being only the troops, although there were some females in the concert parties, but they were fairly risque, some of the stories and things they told, but they were excellent shows, quite professionally done. So yes, that was something that I don't think I'd mentioned before. But to getting back to where we were after the Hook,
yeah,
we were getting towards really the cessation of hostilities. There'd been talk of truce. The peace talks were going on at Parmesan, had been for, well, 2 years as far as I knew, and probably a bit longer than that, almost from the outset of the war. But there was some quite strong rumours coming through that there was going to be a truce. And so I think things had begun to settle down into literally just the odd foray and a little bit of shelling and artillery and mortaring. And so the next event really I remember was Coronation Day, which was in June 53.
What do you remember about that?
Well, I mentioned the old Tiddler Finch, the CQMS before. Somehow, for Coronation Day, he managed to get across to one of the American sectors, and he brought back an enormous tub of ice cream, which for us was a fantastic treat, because, I mean, we never didn't see ice cream, let's be honest. I mean, the Americans had ice cream and peanut butter and all the usual sort of luxuries, but we had nothing. But he did manage to somehow do a trade and got a large sort of quantity of ice cream. So we had ice cream on Coronation Day. And I remember the artillery somehow managed to produce, and I don't quite know how they do it, but they produced red, white and blue smoke shells, which they managed to fire on the Chinese. So we got a display of red, white and blue smoke and ice cream, and that was Coronation Day, as I remember it.
What's the next thing?
So that was June. July, the truce was signed, and there was cessation of hostilities. Unfortunately, I remember one of my friends got killed about, I think, a week before the truce was announced and ceasefires announced, which was tragic as far as I was concerned.
Tell me about him. What happened to him?
He was on patrol and got killed on patrol. He was belonged to the he was a light machine gunner with one of the machine gun platoons, and he got killed about a week or so before the truce was signed. So there's still people getting killed right up to the time of the truce, but activities were much sort of gentler.
Had you had many casualties? You'd been one, but you know, I mean,
I did have some figures. I mean, they were the battalion, I think, during the period though, they had lost somewhere around about the 40 killed. There were a couple of hundred wounded, quite a few prisoners obviously taken.
So quite serious casualties.
Oh yeah, I mean the casualty list was high for the UK. I mean it was the Americans horrendous, but for even the UK, I mean, there was nobody, I think, realised just how many people were killed in the Korean War. I mean, the Iraqi War is pales in insignificance in terms of casualties when you look at what happened in Korea.
So, the war ended
in July.
Anything to mark then?
Well, we just had a bit of celebration. I mean, we had a few beers, and we didn't stand down immediately, obviously, because although the truce had been supposedly signed and war had finished, I mean, there was always that doubt about whether there would be some hang-on activities, which there were one or two little skirmishes just after truce, but then the whole thing wound down and it just became sort of almost a pleasant place to be, to
now
be honest.
What do you remember that phase?
Well, it was much more relaxed. I mean, for a start, it was much more relaxed. Even if you were in forward positions, it was obviously much more relaxed because there was no incoming artillery and it was reasonably quiet. Patrols had more or less ceased, and so the whole thing was just being wound down. And I don't suppose it would be very much different from what you would be if you were serving in this country, really. We were just then sort of, particularly the whole battalion, but mainly the National Service, we were looking forward to getting back to the UK
and
being
demobbed. How did you feel about demob?
Well, I felt happy that I'd survived and that most of my unit and draft had survived with me.
Were you looking forward
to it? I was looking forward to getting back home, obviously looking forward immensely. The last final thing was to go to the War Cemetery at Pusan to have a memorial service for the ones that had been killed in the battalion.
Now, tell me about that memorial service.
It was it was a bit of a heartrend, really, because we'd all lost people that we knew, and they were buried there in Pusan. I mean, there's no question of flying people home or things like that when they killed. I mean, they were just buried on the spot. So it was a pretty large cemetery with a large number of graves, and there's quite a moving sort of memorial service here, held there by the battalion, before he moved to Kure to be shipped back to the UK. So that was a moving experience, and one I won't forget.
Now, how did you get on with the South Koreans? I mean, we haven't talked much about this. Have you,
the Gooks, as we call them.
The
Gooks. They were called Gooks.
How did you get on with them?
They were fine. The ROK, Republic of Korean Soldiers, they were ROKs, so we called the South Korean civvies we called Gooks. The soldiers were ROKs, Republic of Korea soldiers. They were quite good fighters, actually. We got on well with South Koreans. I mean, they were grateful, extremely grateful that we were there. There's no doubt about that. And so they were extremely helpful and were kind people. What we saw, we didn't see many civvies, obviously, where we were.
What
the
about
line.
The civilians who were illicitly helping up forward? You know, the boys that you mentioned.
Well, the house boys. I mean, they were charming lads. I mean, they learned English extremely quickly. They were only in the early teens, and they weren't supposed to be there, to be honest. There was the two that got wounded at the same time I did. There was quite a stink raised about it because they weren't supposed to be there.
And what would they do for you?
Well, they'd help with cooking. They used to do any other chores that you wanted. I mean, they'd make you a cup of tea. They'd do anything they felt they could do to make life more sort of tolerable and bearable for you. And they had a bit of a pseudo uniform. They usually had a some form of a forage cap, and they were well fed, better fed than they would be if they were elsewhere. So they were quite happy to do little jobs and
were
be
they
rewarded
paid?
For no, no.
So they really were, just was board and lodge. Well,
it was just the fact they were with us and they were fed and clothed and in return they did anything that were asked of them to help, you know.
Were they treated well? Because you know the British soldier can be a little hard.
No, treated extremely well. Yeah, the house boys, we call them house boys, they were excellent. We got on extremely well with them. I'd love to be able to find the ones if I could, but I'd never be able to find them. It'd be in the 60s.
So have you got any particular pals you've made? Well, there's one that was killed, but I mean, any other particular friends you remember from that time?
Yeah, the Lance Corporal who I first went with when I was with the support company, with a mortar platoon, chap called Vic Parrish. Vic Parrish. He's recently died, actually. Vic has died in the last year.
What was he like?
He was an older. He was a regular soldier. He was sort of came in, I think, very much at the end of the Second World War. I think he might just have got on the fringes of the war, so he was that old. But he was a bit of a father figure as far as I was concerned. He was extremely helpful to me as a raw signaller. I mean, I was trained to an extent, but there's a lot I had to learn about signalling, and he really became my mentor, and so I got on extremely well with him.
And he was a Lance Corporal?
He was Lance Corporal,
did he get
yeah.
promoted as you did as well?
He stayed with the Mortar Platoon after I left, because I went back and became promoted and went back to headquarter company as a corporal in the headquarter company.
So you sort of leapfrogged him then?
Yeah, yeah.
Did that change your relationship with him?
No,
you still looked up to him?
Yeah, he was very big, was almost like a father figure. And he looked after me extremely well. I think he treated me as he would have treated a lad of his, I think.
Now, was the whole battalion coming home, or just the draft of...
No, the whole battalion was pulling out.
Now, what were the any preparations before you left?
Well, we got everything... When we pulled out of the final camp that we were in, all the battalion equipment, obviously, was shipped down to be shipped back. So I think they were going... I thought they were going back to Germany, but in fact, they went to Suez. They went to Egypt. But all the battalion equipment was got in order, and all the MT stuff was produced and serviced and got ready for shipment. All our kit was sub inspected and made up, any deficiencies were made up and sorted out, and we were then ready basically to board the ship to come back home.
Now what you remember the voyage back?
We came back on the Asturias, which
Asturias.
Was Asturias, A-S-T-U-R-I-S. It was the largest of the troop ships in the troop ship run. There was about 23,000-24,000 tons, which most of them were around about 18,000-19,000 ton mark.
Now what month was this? Was it September or
late August, early September? Not too many recollections about it, other than the fact that we had all the POWs had been released by the exchange of prisoners at the end of the Korean War. All the British POWs came back with us on the Asturias from when we boarded at Kure in Japan. They were given a special diet, they were given special treatment because most of them were quite undernourished, and so they had their own sort of catering facilities and their own part of the ship.
What state were they in?
In the main, I mean, really, it's difficult to say. I mean, they did, some of them looked quite thin and undernourished. They were going to be built up, obviously. They were obviously delighted to be back. We didn't have a great deal of contact with them because for some reason they kept them quite separate. I got to meet a few of them because we got along with doing various chores, obviously, on board coming back home. And you always did on board ship. But the prisoners of war, quite rightly, they weren't given any work or any chores of any kind. It was basically a luxury cruise as far as they were concerned.
So what fatigues were you put on?
I got put with the vegetable cook down in the quarters where they were having their meals prepared, and because I'd lost my stripes, because I weren't what they call a substantive corporal. I was acting lance corporal, became a lance corporal, acting corporal. I was not being a corporal for 6 months, and therefore I lost my rank when I came on board. So I was no longer a corporal. If I'd have been a corporal, I'd have done things like picket duties and things like that, but I did ordinary sort of fatigues. And I became with the vegetable cooks for a few days and spent a lot of time sort of peeling carrots or scraping carrots and peeling potatoes and things, and met quite a few of the POWs and learned a little bit about their life. They didn't want to talk about it a lot, to be honest. I think they'd had a hell of a rough time. They'd been brainwashed to a large extent. I think that was one thing that came across quite clearly, that they had been quite brainwashed. But they had, hopefully, a fairly comfortable trip home, and we helped them in that way, and that we did the chores on board coming back.